Let's open up our Bibles to the 34th chapter of the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 34. We're looking at a guy that he lived his life for so many years on the border of the will of God. And there are a lot of people, and it's easy for us to get there, and it's easy for us to allow a lot of years to go by in the borderland of the will of God. And this is a guy that had many incredible experiences with the Lord. In fact, one of those experiences, you remember, he said that he saw God face to face. What kind of an experience must that have been? And out of those experiences, you remember that he was given the commandment. Number one, the first part of the commandment was you're to go back to the land of Canaan. And then the second part of that commandment was is that you were to be with your family. You're to go back and be with your family. And so he's heading back, and you remember that he runs into his brother. Now, this is the Lord. This is the Lord bringing all these things together so that this man can follow the will of God. And, of course, he's got some issues still with his brother. And you remember that the first opportunity that he has to go back, his brother said, hey, come on south. Come on with me. Stay with me. It's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. And you remember that that guy turns around and he goes north to Succoth. Now, he is in Succoth he's probably there. We assume he's there for a little less than 10 years, just kind of gauging the ages of his kids. So he's probably there 6, 7, 8, maybe 9 years. We don't know. And then for some reason, then he crosses over the Jordan River after that time. And so technically now he's in the land of Canaan. So technically now he has accomplished half of the will of God for his life. But, you know, half of the will of God is still not good enough for God, right? God wants us to follow his will completely. And so he ends up over in the region now, and this is where we left off last time. He ends up in the town, in the village, in the city of Shechem. Now, here's the amazing thing, and this has not been made clear in my mind. I haven't yet quite been able to figure this one out. But, you know, the guy is only about 50 miles, give or take a few miles, from his dad. And so by the time we reach now, chapter 34, you're talking about a man that hasn't seen his father now in 30 years, you know, close to it. His kids have never met their grandfather. I mean, what's up with that? I mean, just go the extra few miles, would you? And just honor your father and be reunited with your dad and let your dad see your kids and all that. And just allow him to enjoy that episode in his life before the guy passed away. But he doesn't do it because he is a man that, for whatever reason, he is a man that just seems to fight God at almost every turn. And the Lord, you remember, the Lord gave him a new name. You're going to be called Israel. You're not going to be called Jacob any longer. But this is basically a father who is not being controlled by the will of God. And when you have a dad that is not being controlled by the will of God, it should be no surprise that the family is going to be out of control. When you see a family that is out of control, I guarantee you most of the time you're going to be able to trace that deal all the way back to a dad that is not submitting to the will of God for his life. Now, chapter 34 is an ugly chapter. I mean, this is an amazing chapter. We have the people of God. Let's not lose sight on who this family is. This is the people of God. This is the family that's going to give us the Messiah. And they are going to perpetrate a great evil. It is amazing, is it not, how the people of God can do such evil things. And it always happens when somebody is setting the tone by not being committed to the will of God. And it all goes back. It all goes back to this dad. It all goes back to a single individual that refused to live the way that the Lord wanted him to live. So we look now at verse 1, and it begins with not one of the sons, but interestingly enough, one of the daughters of Jacob. Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, who was born to Jacob, she went out to see the daughters of the land. Now, she's a teenager at this point. She's probably 16, 17 years of age, somewhere in that vicinity. And one of the great blessings for a teenage daughter is to have a father who is loving, who is protective, and who is strict. Now, oftentimes they don't see that as a blessing, and they don't see it as a blessing until many, many years later. But we understand that when you have a father who is loving, who is protective, and who is strict, he's going to keep that young lady from experiencing a lot of crap that's going to follow her into her adult life. Unfortunately, we have a young lady here that she doesn't have a dad like that. Her dad is consumed with selfishness. Her dad is a guy that is consumed with his own comfort, what he believes is going to make himself happy, and he is not being the patriarch and the overseer of his family that he needs to be. Now, you look at this verse, there's nothing here that would indicate there's any kind of evil on her part. There's no indication here that there's any rebellion on her part at all. Here, you've got a young lady, and we're told there that she went to see, notice, she didn't go to see the boys. That's not what it tells us there. She went there to see the daughters, right? And that word see there, it has the idea of to gaze at. It has the idea of study. I mean, it appears to me that she is just a curious teenager, right? She's now moved into not just a new town, she's moved into a new culture. So what are the girls like here? What do they wear? How do they do their hair? What kind of makeup do they use? And what kind of jewelry do they wear? I mean, everything here just seems to be a very curious young lady, new in the community. How do these kids, you know, interact with each other here? So she's curious, and she's very, very naive. And she is a naive young lady that finds herself now in a very evil culture. And when the naive find themselves in an evil environment, bad things are going to happen. And usually it's bad things happening to the naive. If you're going to go into an evil environment, you better have your concealed carry permit. You better be a good shot. And you better be prayed up. She is none of these things, right? So she is an innocent young lady among wolves. And her innocence now is going to be devoured. And we read of this now in verse 2, where it says that when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the country, when he saw her, very simple, really direct to the point, he took her, laid with her, and he violated her. Now, here again, you have a very naive young lady coming into this extremely evil culture. In this Canaanite culture, this was their chief god, Reshef. Supposedly ruled Mars. He destroyed with plague and fire. He was the god of war. This is the Egyptians' form of this very same god. And these gods were worshipped through the sex act. Understand that this is a culture where life and sexuality, it just doesn't have that big of a value. It's just, what's the big deal? I mean, it's just sex, for crying out loud. What's the big deal? We're just terminating a pregnancy here. And of course, when you've got a culture that's sort of turned over to this kind of overt sexual behavior, you're going to end up with a lot of unwanted pregnancies. And of course, how they got rid of them was to offer them now sacrificially to these gods. Now, Unger, in his book, Archaeology in the Old Testament, he said, excavations in Palestine have uncovered piles of ashes and remains of infant skeletons in cemeteries around heathen altars, pointing to the widespread practice of the cruel abomination. So they would just burn these babies up. And Haley's handbook, I love Haley's handbook, he says, Canaanites worship by immoral indulgence as a religious rite in the presence of their gods, and then by murdering their firstborn children as a sacrifice to these same gods. It seems that in large measure, the land of Canaan had become sort of a Sodom and Gomorrah on a national scale. Did a civilization of such abominable filth and brutality have any right longer to exist? Archaeologists who dig in the ruins of the Canaanite cities wonder that God did not destroy them sooner than he did. All right, so here you've got now a protected young lady.
She now comes into this kind of an environment. Now we're noticing here that we've got a prince, all right? So he's kind of a big deal, kind of a stud, all right, in the community. Now there are people, and maybe your Bible might have this as a subtitle, that it was the rape of Diana. I personally don't see it as a rape situation. We really don't see violence that you would associate with that kind of an action. Now, we're told there that he took her. That's the very same word that was used for the Lord when he took man and placed man in the garden. Clearly, there wasn't any violence associated with that. He laid with her. Pretty much understand what that means. And then we're told there that he violated her. Now, that word it does not necessarily indicate violence. It has the idea of humbled her. It has the idea of him putting her in a situation where she could be embarrassed or thought less of. In the culture that she came from, having this happen in your life would, of course, make you less desirable for the more, you know, the more honorable guys within that culture. So he takes her, and it doesn't really have the earmarkings here of a rape to me. Now this young man's response afterward, I think sort of makes this abundantly clear. Notice in verse 3, we're told there that his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman, and he spoke kindly to the young woman. And so Shechem, he spoke to his father Hamor, and he said, "Get this young woman as a wife." Now that's very caveman-like, I suppose. And Jacob, he had heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now, his sons, they were with the livestock in the field, and so Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak unto him. And the sons of Jacob, what happened there? And the sons of Jacob, they came, and they were, notice now that we're told when they heard it that they were very grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to have been done. Now, very interesting. You're talking about a young man that is a pagan, all right? Now, think about this. This guy is raised, he's been raised, this is all he knows, all right? He hasn't been raised in church, shall we say. He's a pagan. He's been raised now in a culture that belittles sexuality and life and all of this. And so I'm sure that from his perspective, he's probably thinking he's doing an honorable thing. I mean, he's probably thinking, all right, you know, the makeout session got a little out of hand, and so I'm gonna make it right now, and I'm gonna make her now my proper wife. Now, remember, this guy doesn't know God. He doesn't know God, right? But his actions seem to indicate that he's gonna do a good thing. I need to marry this young lady. I mean, if you had a daughter and she was in that kind of situation, and now she's pregnant, and the young man approached you, I mean, I'm sure that you're gonna be angry and disappointed and all of these kinds of things, but yet on the other side, you got to think, well, at least this young man's got a little bit of character, that a mistake has been made, but now he wants to at least to try and rectify the situation as best that he can. So there's sort of an upside to this as well. But you'll notice now that when the big brothers, when the boys get back in town, the stuff hits the fan, doesn't it? And they are grieved. And they are very angry. Now, I take you back to what I read to you last week from the book, The Favored Child. And you remember we talked about how the research shows that when children are unfavored, they're always affected by that. Little Joey is the golden child with a coat of many colors. He's the punk that can't do anything wrong. And now the other boys, they're the ones that are unloved and unvalued and all of that. And you remember that the author said, unfortunately, as that kind
mind of a child now grows up, their anger is likely to be easily ignited and inappropriately expressed. And hence, we've got chapter 34 of Genesis. So these guys are ticked off. Now notice now what the people of God do, right? So he says in verse 8 that Hamor spoke to them saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Now please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us and give your daughters unto us and take our daughters to yourselves so that you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you and dwell and trade in it, acquire possessions for yourself in it." And Shechem, now the young man speaks up, and Shechem said to her father and her brothers, "Now let me find favor in your eyes. Whatever you say to me, I'm gonna give. Ask me ever so much dowry and a gift, and I'm gonna give it according to what you say to me. But give me the young woman as a wife." But the sons of Jacob, they answered Shechem and Hamor her father, and or Hamor his father, and spoke deceitfully because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said unto them, "We cannot do this thing to give you our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach unto us. But on this condition, we will give consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone." Now again, you look at this young man, and you back up there earlier, notice in verse 3 that we're told that he was strongly attracted to her. Notice that he loved her. And that word love is the very same word that is used later on in the book of Deuteronomy for the Jewish Shema, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart." So there seems to be some genuineness there. And notice that he spoke kindly to her. That word kindly there, it means depth. In other words, his conversation with her was not surfacey. There was some depth to the things that they talk about. Notice he's not talking to her before sex. He's talking to her after sex. All right. So I mean, there's a genuine interest in her, not just for sexuality. He has an interest in her after the sex now has ended. He says to them, "Look, I don't care. You tell me." Now, again, this guy, he's a prince, right? He's a wealthy guy, comes from a wealthy family. And he is saying, "I am in love with this gal, and so you just name your price. Name your price. I'll give it." Now, this, you have to understand, Jacob has no idea what's going on here. Jacob is standing there in this room while these negotiations are going on. Apparently, he is silent. Now, he does not know that his sons are negotiating deceitfully. He doesn't know that. He hasn't read the chapter yet, right? He doesn't know how this chapter is going to end. And so he's in this room listening to these negotiations. Look at what his sons are saying. "Hey, we'll give you our daughter, we'll take your daughter, and we will be one people." Do you understand? They are negotiating away the promises of God. And this guy is just standing there not saying a word. Do you understand how clueless this man is becoming? And it is what happens to us when we spend years of our life on the border of the will of God. I am telling you, discernment goes out the window. You've heard of Sleepless in Seattle. This guy is clueless in Shechem, all right? Here are the boys. I mean, what about the stars of the heaven, the sands of the seas, you know, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and all of this? And now all of a sudden, he's listening to his son say, "Yeah, we'll become pagans. Yeah, we'll become what? Sure, we'll become like you guys, no problem." He doesn't know what they are setting up this people for. And so here he is watching the promise of God being negotiated away, and he doesn't give any pushback whatsoever. So then in verse 18, their words please Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And so the young man,
He did not delay. I mean, the boy is in love, isn't he? And to do that, to do the thing, all right? He did the thing. He loved her so much because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. And notice now, commentary, he was more honorable than all of the household of his father. See, a good kid. He's a good kid, right? He's a good pagan, good hellbound sinner, I suppose. He's an honorable guy, and he wants to do the right thing here. And so then Hamor and Shechem, his son, they came to the gate of the city, and they spoke unto the men of the city, saying, "Now these men are at peace with us. Now therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For indeed the land is large enough for them. Now let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters only on this condition." Now here comes the hard sell. The men consent will dwell with us if we be one people, if every male. And you wonder if they said this under their breath. If every male among you will be circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. And now notice, all who went out of the gate of the city, they heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. And every male was circumcised, and all who went out of the gate of the city. Now, please understand what their understanding of the deal was. Notice that Hamor is saying, "We're going to get all of their stuff." I mean, understand, this was their understanding of the negotiation. We're not becoming them. Well, we're kind of becoming them on one level. But for the most part, they are going to be coming us, right? We're not becoming Jewish. They're going to be coming Canaanites is what's going to happen here. And look, man, these guys, I mean, they know how to raise cattle. And they got a lot of wealth here. All of this stuff. And all of it will be ours. Now, you talk about the power of greed. You have got a town full of adult males who are now willing. Now, notice there's not a dissenter among them. I mean, don't you think there'd be somebody that would say, "Hey, wait a minute. I don't care how nice their cows are. I don't think that's going to happen." But notice now the power of greed. Hey, their stuff will be ours. It's amazing what a man will sacrifice for stuff, isn't it? And so without one dissenting voice, they all sign up for this deal. Now notice verse 25 then. "And now it came to pass on the third day," when there was pain, right? No Vicodin, you know, no anti-inflammatories here, no antibiotics. I mean, this is rough business is what this is. Taking a stone to your manhood, and 3 days later, you're in pain, all right? And two of the sons now, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers. Now understand, they were the two full brothers, right? The other brothers were half brothers. And so these two were the full brothers. So obviously there's a little bit more intensity on their part. So these two, notice they took their swords and they came, notice they didn't sneak into town. They came boldly and they killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword. And they took Dinah from Shechem's house. They went out. And then notice the sons of Jacob. So the two went in, they did all the dirty business, they killed everybody. And then the others, they're kind of like vultures. The other boys, they now come in after everybody's dead. And notice they came upon the slain and they plundered, went through their wallets and their pockets and all that stuff. They plundered the dead of the city because, notice they got a good excuse, well, what they did to our sister. And notice they took the sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, and what was in the city, and what was in the field, and all the wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives, they took captive, and they plundered even all that were in their houses. Now, you talk about evil. Now, you think about what the people of God just did. You think about that. You've got one, if we could place blame, there's one guy in that town
that had sex when he wasn't supposed to be having sex. And I suppose that vengeance could have been poured out by the brothers upon the one guy. Everybody else, as it relates to this situation, was innocent. And they killed innocent men. Notice they became common thieves. Notice that we're told there that they took the women and the children and they sold them as slaves, probably sold them to slave traders. I mean, think about what these boys have just done. Now, imagine, they didn't take these guys out behind the city. They didn't take them out into some private, secluded place and whack them there. They whacked them right there in their own house. I mean, can you imagine what that had to do to these little kids? I mean, imagine you got little kids. Somebody comes into your house and stabs you to death. I mean, that's a very violent way to die, by the way. I mean, what kind of scarring would that do to your kids? How would that twist them for the rest of their life? They don't care. They just come in here and they whack everybody. They're out of control. Why are they out of control? They're out of control because their father has set the tone, because he is a man that is not, he's not controlled. And so these guys, it is amazing to me how evil the people of God can be. And now notice, now this is a very human response. Notice Jacob's sterling character here on display in verse 30. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. And I shall be destroyed, and my household, and I." I mean, now this great crime, right? A great crime. How many guys, how many innocent guys lost their life in just a very brutal fashion? How many children were sold as slaves? How many wives were sold as slaves and ended up being raped in that kind of a situation? I mean, this is an atrocity that's been committed. And would you notice now, 8 times in one sentence, he refers to himself, right? They're very human, right? Very human. And then you and I, we're in a car wreck together. You're bleeding from the jugular and I got a boo-boo on my elbow. And the EMS shows up and they start working on you. And why aren't they looking at my boo-boo, right? I mean, we're just always focused on us. And so here he is. There's this great atrocity that's taken place. And he's like, "What does this mean to me?" Right? Very, very human. Now, notice now their response here in verse 31. But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" I mean, you weren't going to do anything. I mean, you weren't going to do anything. You know about it. You didn't say anything. You weren't demanding justice. Now, understand, in that patriarchal culture, This would never have flown, right? It would only fly in Jacob's house, because you see, Jacob is reaping what he had sown. See, he had disrespected his dad in a number of ways. He was continuing to disrespect his dad, not going down, visiting his dad, not going down there and introducing his kids to his dad and all of that. And so these guys, I mean, they put it right back there in their dad's face. Now this is the bunch. This is the bunch that the Lord Jesus Christ is going to come from. Do you understand? The gene pool of Jesus was a cesspool, right? You understand? I mean, sometimes we're embarrassed about the gene pool that we came from. But imagine this crazy, I mean, and we're going to have these stories over and over again in the Old Testament of people doing incredible things. And we think to ourselves, well, I'm bad, but I'm not like those guys, right? I mean, those guys were very, very bad. Now, later on, when Jacob comes to the end of his life, he's going to gather his boys around his bed. He knows he's just about ready to check out. And he's going to bless and he's going to prophesy over them. And he remembers what Simeon and Levi did. And in chapter 49, he says this: "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling places. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them." Now here the Lord is speaking. "I will divide them in Jacob, and I will scatter them in Israel. And so we notice now the judgment that God prophesies here, that they're going to be divided and they're going to be scattered. Now that word divided, it has the sense that, you know, we've got a pot full of money here, and so now we're going to divide it up, right? You know, you get one, I get one, you get one, I get one. And the Lord is saying they're going to be divided like that in the land. It doesn't mean that part of the family is going to be over here and part of the family is, that's what the word scattered means. Now, when you look at how these tribes were divided up, you're able to see that Simeon is right here in the middle of Judah. And what eventually happened is that all of Simeon was divided up and absorbed into the tribe of Judah. And then what happened to Levi? Levi, you remember, they don't get any territory. Levi has the Levitical cities that are given to them that are scattered throughout the land. And so when the land was divided up, Simeon and Levi ended up experiencing the very same thing that Jacob said was going to happen there in Genesis chapter 49. It was because of their anger and because of their cruelty. Now again, all of this goes back to the fact that you've got a dad that just lived there on the borderland of the will of God. He wasn't being controlled by God, and so it shouldn't be any surprise then that his sons were not being controlled by God as well. But where the grace is in all of that is that one of these boys is Levi. And who is Levi? I mean, Levi becomes the priestly tribe. Levi becomes the ones that have the privilege of drawing nearest unto the Lord, that they have the privilege of being in the closest proximity with the Lord. You see, that's grace. That's grace. Here's a man, very violent. Here's a man hurting the innocent. And yet, over time, God brings that man into close proximity with himself. And so I think that as we go to prayer tonight, we need to be praying that the Lord would give us a greater sense of urgency when it comes to his will. That you know, you and I, we can live on the border of that will for years and years and years. And the longer we live there, the denser we become, the less discerning, you know, we become. And we're living in an age, we're living in a time where we need to be discerning. And you're going to receive great discernment when you're just walking there, right dead center. In the will of God. So let's pray that God would give us great understanding and then a great desire to walk in the understanding that he gives us.